and welcome to The Bookmonger. I'm John J. Miller of National Review. Thanks for listening. This show is a production of National Review, and we're recording from the studio WRFH, the campus radio station of Hillsdale College. Our guest is Robert Sirico, author of The Economics of the Parables. Father Sirico, welcome to The Bookmonger.
Great to be with you.
What do the parables of Jesus have to do with economics?
Well, so many of the parables really take place in the real world. And naturally, human interaction is going to involve commerce at some point because we live in the world of scarcity, supply and demand. Just the same way people today are plowing fields or settling inheritance disputes or questions of private property or wages and all the rest of it, all of these are covered in the parables. And I've just chosen 13 of the parables to amplify the presuppositions on the part of Jesus, not that he's teaching economics, but he presumes certain economic realities.
You have 13 parables and 13 chapters. Give us an example of how you draw an economic lesson out of one of these parables.
Let's take the parable of the talents, which is probably the most obvious and very well known. This is where a master entrusts certain investments to three servants. One gets 10, another gets 5, another gets 1. And at the end of the story, the ones who have the 5 and the 10 double their income, whereas the one who has 1 buries it. And the economic saliency of all of this is precisely that the one who doesn't reproduce by virtue of fear, because that's what he says, I was afraid, is condemned not because he lost the money, but because he didn't risk. And that is really a fundamental economic insight, that if you're going to make money, if you're going to be an entrepreneur, you have some risk that's involved. But there's another part of this that's very interesting and subtle. The attitude of this man who refuses to risk, who's afraid, toward the investor is revelatory, because I think it really echoes a lot of Marxist ideas. That is to say, he says to the master, I knew that you were a hard man, reaping where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered. Isn't that exactly the Marxist critique of free economics, that every action in a market economy is exploitative? And this is the attitude on the part of this servant toward the master. And I think that's a very interesting insight. And then, of course, the replenishing of those who have and who produce more in the end even get more than they had at the beginning. So I think those are all economic presuppositions that are going on there, of course, in the context of private property. So many of these parables have as the backdrop of the ownership of private property.
Some Christians read the Gospels, the parables, and come away as advocates of socialism, or at least they feel a temptation towards socialism. They read about Jesus' concern for the poor, his warnings about wealth, and of course we know a little bit about how the early church may have organized itself. Is that a real attraction?
I think it's a fundamental confusion. You know, the parable of the Samaritan, the Good Samaritan, is very often used in this regard. The Samaritan has great compassion for the man who's found left to die by these thieves. It's seen as the paradigm of the welfare state. But when you really look at the passage and let the passage speak to you, it's the antithesis of that. It's this man's personal involvement, not political advocacy, but personal involvement with someone who's in need. So I think it's a confusion. Churchill, who I quote in the book, once said that the socialism of the early church said, all that is mine is yours. But modern socialists say, all that is yours is mine. And that's the flip side of it. In fact, in the afterword of this book, I have a long afterword where I deal with passages in the New Testament that are not parables. I go through that contention that there was early communism in the book of Acts. It's the exact opposite, because Peter in that passage says to the couple who bring their money to him, they're all sharing their wealth in this critical circumstance of persecution. And when this couple come after having sold their property, he condemns them not because it wasn't their property, to sell. And even after they sold it, he says, it was yours to keep, but that you lied about it. So it is not at all socialism. I think the word socialism evokes to many people the notion of sharing. But of course, if you don't have private property, you can't share anything.
A critic might say you're politicizing Jesus. There goes Father Sirico telling his free market fairy tales and using Jesus to do it. What do you say to that kind of criticism?
It's probably on the second page of the book where I address that criticism, because I was very aware that in approaching the scriptures, that I would be accused of that. And in fact, there's a whole literature of people who do exactly that, both on the left and on the right. And I'm very careful to say that the parables of Jesus are not about what we understand to be economics. These are presumptions about human action. My understanding of economics is not about public policy. It's not about mathematics or abstractions. It's human action in the context of scarce resources and how those resources ought to be allocated. And then, of course, the whole intention of the parables is to point to something that transcends this world, but to point to it from within the reality of this world. So I challenge anyone to look at this and say how I have, in scriptural scholarship, they call that eisegesis. Eisegesis is when you put into the text something from outside of it. Exegesis is when you lift out of the text what is in it. And I have exegeted these parables. I have not eisegeted them.
What is a parable? Is it just another name for a story? And what is the power of the parable?
Well, of course, it is a story, but it's more than a story. It's distinct from the fables. The fables, Aesop's fable, the famous one, is fantasy. It's myth. These are not intended to be mythical. These are intended to give us real, common human circumstances. And I think that goes to the question of how enduring they are, how powerful they are, that this could happen to me. I could be in the middle of an inheritance dispute with my brother because he took the inheritance and ran away and then came back, and I'm left, you know, as the outsider of this. This is a very common thing. But there's something else. There's an ambiguity in these parables. It's very frustrating when people read them literally. They come away saying, this is frustrating to me because it doesn't make any sense and it doesn't sound like Jesus. But that's because you're taking them literally, and the whole purpose of it, the ambiguity, is what enables us to think through and imagine ourselves in the circumstances that Jesus is describing. It's very easy to do, even though these are 2,000 years old. The other part of it, too, is that as we meditate on these, we find things that just passed our attention previously. Now, I've been a priest for 33 years. I've been dealing with parables for 40 years, you know, in terms of teaching on them or preaching on them and various things. And as I sat down to finally write this book and put it together, because it was a long time in the making, I discovered new things that really I didn't see before in these parables. The centrality of the father between his two sons and the prodigal son, or in the afterword of the book, where I'm talking about the various other passages, that very famous one, you know, the probably the most famous metaphor in Jesus is about the difficulty of the rich man getting into the kingdom of heaven, harder than a camel to go through the eye of a needle, occurs in the context of the rich young ruler who comes, who Jesus calls to be a disciple. And everybody hears that passage as a denunciation of this man's wealth, when it's not at all. In fact, the first thing Jesus tells that young man to do is go and sell his goods, to liquidate them, not to give them away. He gives them away later. He's told to give them away later. But he's told first to engage in commerce, because that's the way you can be. That's one of the main ways in which we can be good servants. When you come to understand economics for what it is, it's serving other people, anticipating their needs, and then coordinating resources to meet those needs.
One more question. You're the co-founder of the Acton Institute. What's the Acton Institute, and how can listeners learn about it?
Well, acton.org is the website for it, and it was founded some 33 years ago by myself and my colleague, who is now the president of the Acton Institute. I'm the emeritus. And it was to really bring sound economics to good intentions. A lot of religious people, whether they're clergy or business people, have great good intentions to feed the poor, but they don't know how to go about building factories or bakeries or restaurants. That we have to respect business to see that commerce and business and profits are tools to serve the needs of other human beings. And so the Acton Institute offers a wide array of conferences and books and films that help people to do that.
The author is Robert Sirico. The book is The Economics of the Parables. Father Sirico, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Bookmonger.